Hello, I'm Louise Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. You are about to hear New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast, who can explain phenomena such as the museum of one's kitchen and the world in a grain of sand, among many other things. Chast recently collaborated with Steve Martin on The Alphabet from A to Y with bonus letter Z. My conversation with Roz Chast took place on November 26, 2007. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Thank you all for coming. I just have about 15 minutes or so. Not exactly sure of slides to show, and I always like to start with this one. A couple of years ago, I did this drawing for Oprah magazine. They had asked people, various people, to contribute to this article and submit photos of themselves as a child. And I don't know, I didn't want to do that. I didn't have a photo. I didn't want to look for a photo. And it was like, could I draw something? So they said, fine. So I drew this picture of myself at age 9, and I'm lying on the bed, and I'm reading the big book of horrible rare diseases. And I'm surrounded by other books, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Scurvy But Were Afraid to Ask, Diseases of the Tropics, A Child's Garden of Maladies, Lockjaw Monthly Magazine. And I don't know why, but like Lockjaw as a kid was something that I was very, very afraid of. And I didn't even like, you know, the idea of stepping on a rusty nail, as if that were not bad enough. That like, this could happen to you, and then suddenly it'd be like, you know? And it just was a very, very upsetting thought. And the main book of all, which was the Merck Manual, which was something I would say this was the formative book of my childhood, because, you know, this was always around the house, and I would pick it up from time to time, even though I knew I shouldn't. It's kind of like, you know, when you're in Barnes & Noble, and there's, like, the disease section, and you know, don't go there. Do not go to the disease section. Do not look up. You know, there's a book actually called Symptoms, and I think, don't look at it, and yet I am compelled. I have to go. So this is the way it was when I was a kid. We had this Merck manual around because my mother's sister was a nurse, and she gave it to her. My mother was a doctor, wanted to be a doctor, but wasn't. And so she, you know, I think I just kind of grew up with this. And of course, the book is, you know, very, very complicated, and I was just, you know, like 9, 10 years old. But I couldn't understand most of it, but I could read Symptoms and Signs. And, you know, leprosy, oh, yeah. You know? Any, you know, feeling of malaise. Oh, yep, that's leprosy. It's coming down the pike. You know, I'm not. It's tetanus. Any, you know, lockjaw. Anything like, you know, slight tension. And, you know, well, I know. You know, rusty nail. It's kind of like brushed against me, and I must have had a cut there, and the rust kind of. Anyway, so this is kind of. Anyway, this is a cartoon that ran in the New Yorker, the little engine that coulda, woulda, shoulda, and he's thinking, I knew I could, so why didn't I? This is Rosemary's Baby Turns 27. I don't care who you are. It's time you found a job and got your own place. Oh, Ma, leave me alone. I mean, I love dousing. It's such a great idea. You know, you could just get this little stick and I don't know. I'd like to have one that, like, opened up to an umbrella or, you know, just kind of did, like, you know, what is that? Well, it's my dousing wand. This is a cartoon that ran recently. It's called The Seven Deadly Virtues. We have morning perkiness. Isn't this a glorious day? And uncalled for thrift. Dented cans of peas, only 39 cents. And I always pass that. Like, there's a Stop and Shop where I live, and there's always this, like, one sad area behind, you know, like in the bakery aisle, and it's like one bin, and it's just these, like, dented cans, and they're not that cheap. I mean, it's not like peas are that expensive. So, you know, maybe you're saving, like, 14. I don't know. It's, like, very strange. Anyway, total honesty. In fact, that does make you look fat. Over seriousness, I only read the classics. Gossip prudery. If you can't say anything nice, don't say it at all. Guilt mongering. How can we go to the carnival when people are starving? And fitness obsession. My resting heart rate is 2 beats a minute. He's very strong. This is a drawing from the book I did with Steve Martin, The Alphabet from A to Y with Bonus Letter Z. And I wish that I had the book in front of me, which I forgot to bring, because then I would read the couplet that went along with it. But it was something like, let's see if I remember this. Amiable Alice, Amy and Andy ate all the anchovy sandwiches handy. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Oh, it just magically appeared out of nowhere. And the thing that was fun about this book was that the couplets, I think, are really a lot of fun. But in the drawings, there's so many other... I tried to put lots and lots of different words that began with A in the drawing so that, you know, presumably the kid could look at the drawing and say, wait a minute, you know, there's an alligator under the coffee table, and look at the name, and the older the kid is, the more they'll recognize, like, you know, there's a suit of armor, there's an abacus, the books on the coffee table say Art of Antarctica, all about algebra, asparagus acres, Aaron's appendicitis almanac, and there's a little tube on the coffee table, it's of some kind of ointment called Acne Away. But then there's, like, little things that, like, maybe the kid won't notice that, like, the pattern on the lampshade is ampersands and, you know, things like that. So there's a lot of, like, hidden stuff in the drawing. This is the letter E, and the poem is, Excellent Edward, exceedingly picky, ate eggs with an eel whose earwax was icky. I don't know. I like this one. There's lots and lots of little hidden things in this. There's the elephant collection. There's come to Egypt, enter and exit. There's a little tiny Eskimo. There's a East Ridge Elementary School. There's, you know, just a lot. And of course the book on the floor is a diagram of an eyeball. And, you know, I just thought, like, if a kid doesn't know that actually inside your head there's, like, this big sphere of, like, eye. And, you know, just maybe they should know that it's not just like that little friendly thing that you see in the front. It actually goes like, you know, they should know that. The same way it was forced upon me when I saw it in the World Book Encyclopedia, that diagram of, you know, they hold the eyeball open like this, and then it's like, oh my God, you know, it's like there's a whole thing going on back there. So this is the X, and it's ambidextrous Alex was actually axed for waxing then faxing his boss's new slacks. And there's just, I think one thing that's fun is that not all of the words have to start with X, that it's the sound of X that this poem is kind of about. And anyway, so that's the book. This is... a cartoon that the daughter is the mom is kind of doing a little dance and the daughter says stop, you're hurting me. Okay, this is also another cartoon from the New Yorker. This is the delusional world of the free range chicken, and the one chicken is saying, "This is the life, isn't it? You said it, sister. I'm going to explore that big wide world out there. Ain't no stopping us now." This is sort of kind of a downhill trajectory. This is the very first cartoon that the New Yorker took from me in 1978, And even now, I mean, this was very, very strange for them. And even now I look at it and I think this was a strange choice because, you know, out of all of the cartoons I submitted that first time, I submitted about 60 cartoons, and this was probably the weirdest one. And I still don't know why they took it because it was so personal. I mean, it was the kind of thing that, like, you know, when you're just kind of sitting there and you're doodling and, you know, making up just kind of, you know, well, maybe you don't do it, but... this is, you know, when I'm sitting at my desk and I'm just kind of like doodling around and thinking funny sounds and Cabe. well, but anyway, so they took this one, and when they ran it, I think I was young enough that I just had, you know, blinders on. I didn't really know like how upsetting it was to people, and apparently it really was. I mean, a couple of people canceled their subscriptions, and you know, barbarians. And my editor told me about this later, and in fact, he told me that when they ran it. One of the older cartoonists asked if he owed my family money. This is another old cartoon. This is, I don't know, I'm turning around to look to see if it's like up on the screen. This is a mailbox. It says the Cranes, 1,022,796 West 79th Street. This is Radiator Cookery. Flounder takes 2 days, potato 3 weeks, 5 days, and a roast takes 4 months and 9 days. This is sort of sums up a lot. This cartoon, this is the gift from the House of Low Goals, and I got the idea for this cartoon. You know, people always say, "Well, where do you get your ideas?" And this one I really did get from a very specific source, which was I was on the train and I saw a poster, an ad for it was for Carvel, and it was on a commuter train coming home from New York, going out to the suburbs, and it was this big cake, and. On the frosting of the cake, it said, "Congratulations on your new glasses." And it was this little girl with new glasses, like with this big smile, like her mom or dad had like brought home a cake, you know, for her that said, "Congratulations on your new glasses." And I thought, I never heard of that. You know, that's so made up. That's such BS, you know, that's ridiculous. Although, you know, just the other day I saw this ad for IHOP, and it was insane. It was like, I don't know if I'll ever use this in a cartoon because it was already a cartoon, but it was "Surrender to Pancakes." And then, as if that weren't enough, it was just this, like, giant, like, thing of pancakes, and I couldn't even figure out, like, what meal is this? This is, like, this pile of pancakes with like frosting and ice cream and like whipped cream and cherries on. I'm thinking like, this isn't breakfast and it's not lunch and it's not dinner and I don't know what it is. It's like, let's just throw all these meals out the window. Let's just like forget that there's even such a thing as meals and just, I don't know, it was really crazy. And then it said, as if this weren't enough, then it said, "You have no choice but to surrender." I don't know, it was just crazy. So anyway, that's where the idea for this cartoon was. It's like the t-shirts, "I survived conjunctivitis, I can read a bus schedule, 100% human DNA," and the cakes are like, "Wow, only 6 cavities." "Happy tattoo removal, and no loitering arrests in 1 year." And you have cards like, "I'm so glad you're not an arsonist." "And congratulations on your new easy chair." And trophies, it's just participant. So this is Afghanigap. So we have classic, cargo, pleated front, flat front, slim fit with lycra, relaxed fit, and cropped. This is a... Uh, in a... MRI of love. You know, I like this, you know, the genre of the tunnel of love joke. So, this is a cartoon that was in Scientific American. This is alternative illnesses for alternative medicine. We have feldspar deficiency, pseudokarma, past life bursitis, and a leaky aura. This is a gravestone. Tuned in, turned on, dropped out, dropped in, worked out, saved up, dropped dead. This is a dream parents. This ran in the New Yorker a few months ago. Oh, you definitely look like a cheap slut in that. Have fun. See you whenever. And you're going out with Johnny? Ooh, I saw his name in the police log. He's famous. This was the first cover I ever did for the New Yorker, and it's a kind of an evolutionary chart of ice cream, and starts out with a scoop and goes into all these different sort of variations of it. But this is a Nancy Drew Mysteries, the later years. This is a. I don't know if you can read it back there. This is a. Can you read them back? Oh, okay. This is Nancy Drew and the Missing House Keys. I know I left them right there. Nancy Drew and the Mystery of the 8 Pounds. How did I gain 8 pounds? I eat nothing. And Nancy Drew and the Secret of the Computer. You and I are going to be great friends. This is an obituary page joke. It's a very educational reading. That horrible thing, well, I'm totally safe. He was 2 years older than me. This is acupressure points. We have, ouch, quit it. This isn't helping at all. Will you please stop? No, leave that alone. Chuck, you Farley. Stop touching me. Cut that out. Don't, and uncle. And this is the kid who learned about math on the street. If you, if you divide 6,973 by zero, you die. Once this guy tried to find out the square root of -9, and his eyeballs turned black. And this girl my brother knows found out exactly what pi equals, but she went nuts. This is a... The little carts. This is the pharmacologist of Oz. Scarecrow gets his Ritalin, Tin Woodman gets L-Dopa, and the Cowardly Lion gets Xanax. Everything's great. This is a mom and pop grocerette. We never see you anymore. What's the matter? Maybe we don't carry enough of your fancy gourmet items? Guess you're all grown up now and have your own life, and don't worry about us. This is a. I went through this phase, this like mania really, of doing Pysanky eggs. I decided I really wanted to learn this technique, and I did. I found somebody who knew how to make these eggs. They're very intricate. They're real chicken eggs, and you do this kind of wax resist technique. It's a little bit like batik, where you draw with the wax is where the ink is not going to go. So it's too boring to explain exactly how it's done. But I learned how to do them, and I did them. They're not painted. They're kind of dyed and etched in this weird sort of way, and it was really interesting, and I went nuts with it and did like 300 of them, and then it was just like enough. But anyway, this was a drawing. This was a guy who was part of this person on the subway. It's hard to, you know, it's very hard to kind of photograph something in the round. But anyway, this was a subway. This was some people sitting at a counter in a luncheonette. This is a weird family. This was some girl. Face. And this was just a few of this is a small sampling of them. I'm telling you, I could not stop doing them. It was just obsessive. This is a. The old, those end of the world guys, I love them. They're so great. And he needed a wife, so I gave him one. And this is The Vain But Realistic Queen. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who if she lost 10 pounds and had her eyes and her neck done and had the right haircut could in her age group be the fairest one of all? That's it.
On the screen. Thank you so much.
Oh, am I supposed to move this?
Yeah, move that.
All right, okay.
Okay, pull it in a little bit more.
More.
Electric shock.
Okay,
good. All right. Okay.
All right. Hi. Okay. A woman I know wrote to me that she couldn't be here tonight, but she wanted you to know that your mother was her favorite high school English teacher.
Oh,
and she
God.
Said she was fantastic. And she also said that Woody Allen was her classmate. Is this true?
Yes. It was not high school. It was grade school. Yeah.
So did your mom teach everything?
No, she didn't teach in high school. She taught.
It was an elementary school class, so it was
she taught everything. Yeah, in elementary school.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Was she funny?
No, I think not intentionally.
Did you have anyone in your family that was particularly funny? I mean, that
intentionally?
You,
no.
Yeah. Like an Uncle Roy. I have an uncle that would like get up and tap dance at family gatherings and kind of.
No, no, they were pretty grim.
Pretty grim.
Yeah. I found that sort of the grimmer they were, the funnier it was to me. So life is a serious business. You could die if you touch that.
Yeah, I know. My grandmother's was, don't run, you'll fall down.
Very popular. A lot of that.
So. Were you around a lot of Yiddish by any chance as a kid?
Yeah, I was.
Because there are a lot of words for different anxieties and things, like kind of like Eskimos have snow, you know?
Yeah, there's probably all different forms of anxiety.
So I thought maybe the sound of those
also
little
some,
words.
Some wonderful curses.
And wonderful curses.
Things like, may your spleen explode. I love that.
Yes, it's very good. That's very, very good. You attribute the phrase, the conspiracy of the inanimate, I think, to your mom. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I think she actually got that from someplace else.
But was there a conspiracy of the inanimate in your household?
Oh, I think definitely. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, you know the way things, you know, objects just kind of sort of go off on their own horrible tangents. I was always afraid of electricity. In fact, the same kind of thing when I discovered that, like, actually your eyeball wasn't just this, like, pretty thing in front, that it actually,
so
like, went deep into your head and was, like, connected to muscles and was filled with, like, vitreous humor and, ugh. Like, the idea that when I realized that there were things inside of the wall, like, that there were wires in there, and when I remember when I learned this, it was a book, it was, like, one of the Scholastic Book Services, it was a biography of Helen Keller, and she was lying in bed, and she felt the wall, and it was warm. And she knew this was bad because then there was a fire in the wall. And somehow I would lie in bed and touch the wall and think, like, I think this is warm. And, you know, is this, like, warm? Am I imagining it? Is my hand warm? You know, maybe I'm like...
Just ordinary worries for a child, I think.
Well, I didn't like the idea that there's stuff inside the wall. I still don't like this idea.
And were you bothered by the idea of, like, you know, water going down the drain, like the things could be sucked down?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that's also very, very frightening.
It's upsetting.
Yeah. I once saw a kid have a complete meltdown over that. It is very, very, very,
it's
very
terrible.
Upsetting. Yeah. Were there any books that you read as a child other than, like, the Merck Manual and, you know, like, were there favorite childhood favorites of yours?
I was just talking about this with somebody the other day, those old Warner Brothers cartoons, those AAP cartoons. I mean, there was a lot of stuff about, like, you know, kittens falling down holes in backyard and being, like, sucked down drains and stuff like that.
There's the
tin. Maybe I imagined it. I don't know.
There's the tin soldier in Hans Christian Andersen, and he goes down the gutter and goes on that, and then he ends up in a fish's stomach. That was very upsetting.
Yeah,
that was extremely upsetting. You've mentioned that both Charles Adams. In fact, you've written a little bit about Charles Adams in that wonderful little piece in the New Yorker where they showed his cartoons, you know, kind of a compendium of them. And Thurber were both, inspirational to you. Can you tell us what you liked about their work? Two very different artists, of course.
Charles Adams was definitely more of an inspiration to me than... I like James Thurber, but Charles Adams was the first... I think that was the first cartoonist that I discovered when I was a kid. My parents used to go to Cornell in the summer. They were school teachers, and there was a whole contingent of them from Brooklyn who would go up to Cornell in the summer and take classes, or we would live in student housing, you know, graduate student housing, and because it was cheap. And they would go to lectures, and when they went to lectures, they would park me, and they had a lending, like a browsing library. And they had one section that was all cartoon books, and it was mostly like these old, you know, Whitney Darrow and Peter Arno, and a lot of that stuff I liked to look at, but I didn't really completely get, especially if it had, you know, jokes about, you know, cocktail parties. I didn't know what they were talking about. But the Charles Adams, they had all those books, like Black Mariah and Monster Rally, Adams and Evil, Drawn and Quartered, and I could look at those books over and over again and just loved them. I mean, I think because they were so dark and so funny and sort of transgressive in this sort of way. And I think it was also kind of cool because I knew that they were adult, but I also got them. And they weren't pandering to children in any way. And they were just really funny.
Well, you should know a friend of mine's son, who's, I think, 10, sits for hours only when they go on vacation to his grandmother's house where they have all the old New Yorkers, and he studies your cartoons. And I said, Noah, do you want to give me some questions for Roz Chasti? No, he wanted to keep it to himself, but he laughs hysterically.
Oh, good.
But
Got
to get him when you're young. Really early on, you know, just even with that very first cartoon you showed that was taken by the New Yorker, you veered away from the traditional gag form. And you do such innovative things with triptychs and diagrams. And is there a source for that, or have you just always kind of played with form on the page in terms of telling a story or an idea?
Well, I think one thing about working for the New Yorker as opposed to doing like a strip for a newspaper is that we are given the freedom to do different forms. I mean, for me, different cartoons need different forms to show them the best. I mean, if it needs to be a full page, I do it in a full page. If it needs to be one panel, I'd rather do it in one panel. I like to let the content of it determine what form it's going to take and not just say, well, what I do is a four-panel thing and everything I do has to be four panels. That would make me insane.
For instance, what's the one that where the aunt so-and-so makes the sweater and it makes...
Right. Oh, kind of goes around in a circle.
Yeah, that's... Yeah. And it really does. I mean,
yeah,
you have to follow it around, which makes sense because it's
a
life cycle.
Yes, it is. It is.
Follows 1,000 years or so.
Yes, no, maybe more. 20,000. It doesn't really matter. It's the same thing.
Few of your drawings are kind of outright political, except for two that I found in here, which were there was the get well card from Dick Cheney to Harry Whittington.
Oh.
And then there were thank you cards for Ralph Nader. Okay. When everyone can buy a gun without too much ado, a few will say, who paved the way? And I will think of you. Way to go, pal. Mm-hmm. So did you feel like you were kind of pushed over the edge towards
that? Yeah, I was mad.
No, that was really great. Since everyone I've been polling kind of has their favorite one of your cartoons, what are some of yours? Or is there some that, you know, you just always refer back to?
They're all my children.
They
I
are.
Love
I
them
understand.
Equally. I don't know. I know. I think it changes. It changes too much.
Changes too much because you're always making them too.
They're
coming up. They're one of them. Your strange proverbs. I was hoping that there might be some leftovers. That they're like outtakes. Or will there be more strange proverbs? Do you think? Do they occur to you every now and then? Because we can always use more strange proverbs. I beg you. I know, where the question which you even mentioned when you were up there, people always ask where your ideas come from, and I know you don't like that question. It's kind of a horrible question. But what if there were just, if we kind of throw out a few like words or images and see if anything bubbles up that will occur to you? Like, does bubonic plague you know, have any associations?
There's nothing funny about the bubonic plague. No, there isn't. Bubos. No. Is it bubos or bubos?
I think it's bubos.
Bubos.
Memory foam.
I hope I don't get any bubos. Yeah, see, it's really not funny.
It's not funny.
Not funny at all. Really funny.
No. What about memory foam?
Memory foam?
Yeah, like mattresses that, like, you're laughing. So
yeah.
It could. How about toys from China?
Toys from China. Oh, no, no.
No.
Nothing. See, now it's like all horrible.
All horrible.
Like, there's nothing funny about any of this.
Cell phones? Nothing about...
I'm depressed now.
Okay. Okay, well, I don't want to depress you. Yeah. Perhaps you have some questions. We're not going to go any further with this. But I did want to ask before, were there any magazines that you subscribed to besides, say, like Erin's magazine and Snacks magazine? Like, you did subscribe to some very strange ones, didn't you?
I did, for a while, get a magazine called Snack Food. And
it was a magazine
for the snack food industry. And it's a great magazine. The ads are wonderful because they have these, like, if you want to, like, I guess make your own, like, massive quantities of, like, Bugles, and they're like these huge machines that kind of, you know, make Bugles or, you know, whatever, Chex Mix or something, not just like in the little tiny like bucket full, but like, you know, tons of it at a time, so extruders and things. But the best was they would have an article of it, and I'd learn terms like mouth clearance, which was something like when they would talk about chips and they would talk about like how big the chip was in relation to your mouth. And like if the chip was too big, it was like kind of like a car going into a garage or something, I always pictured. So it had to have like not only the right taste, but like the right amount of mouth clearance.
That's very technical. So that someone's really thought, it's amazing that someone's thought about all these things. It used to amaze me just when you walk down the street that you would see so many things and you go like, someone made this. Like there has to be a place where they make these things, you know, like those little attachments for the podium or this thing or snacks, you know.
Yes,
and they have to make special machines.
And wouldn't you like to go to that factory and just,
like,
watch them make...
Did you go on field trips? Did they have such things where you went to school in Brooklyn?
No.
Here we had the Helms Bakery. I grew up in Culver City, and we'd go, and then you'd see the whole assembly line, and everyone would have, like, a little loaf of bread that you would get at the end. Yeah, it was really...
We didn't have that.
Really quite wonderful. We're going to open it up to you to ask Roz Chass questions, and Libby has the microphone, so why don't we start up there?
Thank you for joy. The fact that your parents were high school teachers, I'm wondering, were your grandparents first generation, and did they come over with lots of superstitions and fears?
Yeah, all my grandparents were first generation. I guess my parents were first generation Americans. My grandparents all came over here from other tiny villages where there were probably lots of superstitions and don't sit on the ground. You know, you could get like a kidney infection if you sit on the ground. I heard that. I still somewhere deep down in me believe that. If you sit on the ground, you will, because somebody knew somebody that happened to. So...
How about over there?
Hi. Who's the first person you show a cartoon to?
The way it works is we all, there's about 30 or 40 staff cartoonists at the New York...
In your family?
Oh, in my family? No.
In your friends?
No. No, that does not happen. Now, every once in a while, I might show something to one of my kids or something. But no, generally, I just kind of, you know, wait until after the carnage is over.
They have to see it in the magazine like everybody else.
Yeah, pretty much.
Do they go through many incarnations? Usually kind of come right out, or do you kind of play with
it? It really varies a lot. I mean, especially the longer ones, I'm constantly revising and patching and cutting up and, you know, doing all kinds of weird things too. And every once in a while, something is pretty coherent when it first happens, but not
And when you're on the road like you are this week, do you kind of have like, are you working at the same time? Or are you kind of like resolving certain parts of pieces that you're working on?
Not exactly. I mean, I jot down ideas if something happens. I mean, that's just habit. But I'm not like working on any specific thing.
Has LA inspired any bouts of absurdities?
I won't know it till I come
home. You won't
know,
okay. Yeah. But over there.
So during your Pysanky period, did your family go on an omelet binge?
No. Because what happens is you don't take the gook out of the egg until after it's all died. And I think that the dyes are pretty poisonous, or some of them are. So unless I was feeling... Say what? Unless I was feeling particularly hostile, it's probably better to, you know, get rid of the eggs.
I think you had one right there.
I wanted to hear the answer to the question that you were interrupted. You started to say that there are 30 to 40 cartoonists, and then you were talking about the process of sending cartoons.
The process is a weekly routine, and it really has not changed that much since I started in 78. Where there's about 30, 40 people on staff, and we each submit, I would say, between maybe 5 and 15 sketches a week. I'm on the lower end of that. I'm more like between 5 and 8, because some of mine are like long and, you know, long. I rationalize it that way. Anyway, that's what I tell myself. I do these sketches, and then the art meeting is on Wednesday, and so my deadline is like Tuesday evening. I fax in what we call the batch. And then the art meeting is David Remnick, who's the editor-in-chief of The New Yorker, Bob Mankoff, who's the cartoon editor, and then they usually have a couple of other editors around who come in, sit on the meetings. And from what I understand, I've never been to one of these. I've been told that they kind of spread them out on a big table, or actually Bob Mankoff makes a preliminary selection, because you couldn't possibly bring in, you know, let's say 40 people times 10, that's 400 drawings, and then you have drawings from the slush pile. You know, I mean, that would be like, you know, 600 drawings a week, so he has to cull from those a certain number, like maybe 100, and then they lay them all out, and then they buy something like 20 drawings a week from all of that. So your percentage of what you make compared to what gets bought is pretty, it's not great. If I'm lucky, I sell one. If I'm extremely lucky, I'll sell two. And, you know, sometimes I don't sell any, so that's just the way it always works.
About right here. I'm sorry, let me keep you.
I often try to do the contest in the back of a magazine, and I'm never successful. I'm not nearly clever enough to come up with anything worthy of even submission, but. What's more difficult, to have the cartoon first and come up with a catchphrase, or have a catchphrase in your mind and then come up with a drawing?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't have like really positive feelings about the cartoon contest, the caption contest. So I tend to just kind of pretend it's not there. So it doesn't exist for me. I don't even think about it.
Because when you work, you're kind of thinking of the idea and the image at the same time, usually?
Well, sometimes, most of the time, it's the idea first, and then the drawings come after. But every once in a while, I'm doodling, and like the one with the end of the world guy, I was doodling, and I really wanted to draw an end of the world guy, and then it was after that I realized I needed to draw him a wife. And so that came about, the drawing came about first, but most of the time for me, it's the other way around.
What was it like collaborating with Steve Martin? Was it, I mean, since you weren't, this was one instance where you weren't the writer. And I know he has so much respect for you as a writer, too, so.
Well, I've illustrated children's books before. I mean, in this case, it was really a pleasure. I mean, he's really smart and funny and very generous, and it was a good. I knew when I read the verses that it would be a lot of fun to illustrate, and it was. It's, you know, better than I've done. I think the worst children's book experience I had, and it was, you know, something. It involved animals, and it was outdoors, and I don't even like going outside, and I don't know how to draw the outside. I'm not interested in it at all, and it was like in the woods, and I remember like there was a double page spread of these animals in the woods, and I had to draw like a woods, and it was like I didn't even know what to do. I mean, it was like, you know, what's on the floor in the woods? It's like there's leaves.
And there's no lamps.
And there's no lamps. There's no tables. There's no carpets. There's no nothing.
It's wallpaper.
Like leaves. And then you might put a rock over here. And then I'm supposed to, what, a bunch of grass over there? I mean, I didn't even, it was like I was totally lost. And I started looking at photos of like outdoors. And it was crazy. It was horrible.
But the coffee dousers are outside in that wonderful kind of, you know, morning meadow. The dousing for coffee.
Oh, yes. That's about my extent of drawing outside. It's, you know, got a few trees in the background, and that's it.
Yes.
Do you go to garage sales?
Oh, yeah. Love garage sales. Yeah.
Anyway, how about that one there?
Is there a cartoonist union, and are you a member of it? And have you ever gone on strike?
There's no cartoonist union. We're like totally. I think we're so dispensable. I don't know.
What are some cartoons that got rejected that you can't understand why they got rejected?
Oh God, I have tons. I have so many, and I have ones that I've like submitted, you know, millions of times that I just thought were just so funny, and I'll resubmit them, you know, because I think possibly the two pages in the fax machine stuck together. Or maybe when he was looking at this, he had a horrible toothache and he associated the pain of his tooth with this drawing, you know. I can't even remember right now. It's probably too painful and I've repressed it. But, you know, there's definitely been cartoons that, you know, I like, and they don't. All right, here.
When you were very young, were you exposed to Mad Magazine, and did you like it?
Oh, I loved Mad Magazine. That was the other, you know, first thing when I was a kid, besides Charles Adams. It was like Don Martin, and oh, God, they were so great, just so funny. And, you know, also just making fun of things that, you know, people were sort of taking kind of seriously, you know, advertising and stuff like that.
There.
As a child, did your family view you as some kind of oddity? Or are they more loving than that?
I think that as long as I did okay in school and I didn't make much trouble, like what I did in my free time was like of not really very much interest or concern. and also it's not like being like a sword swallower. I mean, for all they knew, I was doing like my math homework, you know? So it's not.
And then there's one up there.
Is there anything you can do with a rejected cartoon other than bury it?
I rework them, I resubmit them, and I'm also, the arrangement I have with the New Yorker is first refusals, which means that I can submit, as long as the New Yorker's rejected it, I can submit it other places, which I can and I do.
Thank you for your fantastic work.
Well, thank you.
Two quick ones. Did you go to art school?
Yes.
And can you embellish on that? And also, I just want to stick one. Do you get edited ever or in the past, the text? Or do they give comments on your image, ask you to make changes or anything?
I did go to art school. I went to Rhode Island School of Design. And also when I was in high school, I went to the Art Students League on Saturdays. I took figure drawing, believe it or not, and I don't It's with cartoons, I think that they don't, usually if they don't like something, they just reject it, you know? I don't think that, it's not like a short story where, you know, an editor works with you, you know, on a kind of one-to-one basis. Although I have had, I mean, I remember my favorite editing or suggestion was Bob Mankoff liked a cartoon, but he said, there's something here, but he's just like, actually he didn't even say it. He just gave it back to me and he said, make it funnier. And... I thought okay, and I did, and then I sold it. But it was kind of like a funny little kind of comment. I thought.
Were there stand-up comics that influenced you, or people like Nichols and May, or anyone like that, in addition to the cartoonists?
I love Bob and Ray. I just think they are incredible. So funny. But
right there, and those two in that row.
You said that you went to art school. Did you have, before you thought of being a cartoonist, did you have an idea of being an artist, a straight artist?
From when I was little, I used to draw cartoons. And when I went to art school, it was really the one time where I got away from drawing cartoons. Because when I was in school, cartoons were really thought of as kind of, I think... sort of embarrassing. They were like, not only like the, you know, at the children's table, but they were kind of like a little bit at the embarrassing relatives table. It was like, you know, I mean, RISD was very serious about art, and drawing cartoons was kind of like being like that kind of like nutty, like Aunt Judy, like who's like putting like, you know, chopsticks in her ears or something, and, you know, embarrassing everybody. And I started to feel really embarrassed about drawing cartoons and being funny and everything like that, and you know, because everybody was, you know, being very minimal and doing these things where, you know, there'd be installations with, you know, video monitors, and it would be like 8 video monitors in a room with like a lot of static, and that would be the art piece. And I thought, oh, you know, that never even occurred to me. Well, I guess that's really what I should be sort of doing, or like, you know, some canvas, and there'd be like one black line, and then it would be about, you know, suffering and pain and, you know, I don't know. So drawing cartoons was, then I got back to drawing cartoons when I got out, because by my senior year, it was just like, I don't know how to do any of this. I did start, majored first in graphic design, which was really the wrong thing for me, because a lot of it was about being very neat and straight lines. And I remember having this assignment where we had to build this cube, a 12-inch cube, and I had to, like, measure. Oh, it was horrible. And, like, you have to, because to make each side be 12 inches, you had to, like, compensate for the width of the cardboard, and then the glue would get, like, gook out of the side, and then you'd, like, try to clean off the glue, but, like a little piece of the white part. It's, like, too boring. But I thought, okay, so then I switched to illustration, which was, like, boring for other reasons, and then I wound up majoring in painting because that seemed to be the artiest of all arts. But it was also a disaster. And I went back to cartooning. So,
and aren't we lucky? Over there. Right, no, right, yeah.
How did you select the cartoons we saw at the beginning?
I have learned from doing these shows that the ones that require a lot of reading, I get about halfway through reading them and I think, this is so boring, I want to die. I want to die. I want to kill myself right now. I want to, you know, and so I thought, like, well, okay, I only really should show slides that are not these long, long, you know, because you can just feel like everybody kind of like starting to just die and, you know, wanting to leave and thinking about what they need to buy, you know, the Stop and Shop and stuff, and then I don't want that, so.
Right there.
Louise asked a question about form, and I do have a morbid fascination with the structure of comedy. And seeing the work up there, it became really clear that you are a master of comic timing in this amazing static moment. And I'm just so impressed at how you managed to compress time into this chunk of space. And I'm hoping you can talk about that a little bit.
I know.
He was a physics major.
Yeah.
Sorry, Craig. Sure. Right there. Sure.
Well,
I have a question about what kind of greeting cards you send to people, especially at Valentine's Day, because years ago you had a cartoon in The New Yorker about Valentine's to myself. Do you remember it? And, oh, I have been sending that Valentine to my two sons for years, and every year they get a kick out of it. So I'm wondering, what kind of greeting cards do you send to people?
mostly email, not e-greeting cards, which are really pathetic, and I hate that. But
Hallmark has never, you know, like tried to headhunt you.
No, although I did go out to Hallmark a year or two ago
in Kansas City.
In Kansas City, and that was really, oh my God! I mean, it was really funny because I was kind of like making fun of certain things, and then I realized, like, you know, these are people who write these, because I was talking about those kind of, you know, those ones that have like that kind of those horrible poems on the front, like, I know we two disagree, but and yet there comes a time in everyone's life when you have to put aside the wheat of disagreement for the flower of happy, you know, and it's like whatever, and they're written in like that fake handwriting, you know, and there's usually like a pastel like sunset behind it, and I was talking about this at the talk, and then I realized these people are like, you know, a couple of them are looking at me and they're like not smiling at all, and it was really a bad moment. I love his work.
Up there?
No.
Well, so your comments about RISD were really interesting because I just graduated from college and a couple of my friends majored in art and submitted graphic novels as their senior theses. So how do you see, I mean, there's so much sort of debate and everyone has their opinion about cartoons and graphic novels and comic books and whatever you want to call it, it's all in this same genre. And what do you think about sort of the way that genre has changed?
Well, there's definitely a lot more sort of this out there than when I got out of school, which is great. I mean, I just came from a bookstore down to Book Soup, and they had this whole area of these wonderful, you know, books of graphic novels and Daniel Clowes, and then the whole, you know, the manga influence and the Japanese stuff, and, you know, it's fantastic. It's great. They did not, when I'm in my day,
Libby.
When there, I got out of school millions of years ago, you know, there really wasn't this, so.
I take two more. So there's someone here and then someone up there.
Is anybody making a musical out of your work?
Theories of everything.
Not that I've been told. I don't know.
What if they've been doing it and then they're going to just reveal it and they'll be brought to a theater and as a giant surprise?
It would be like, this is your horrible life.
Up there.
I wanted to know how many kids you have, how old they are, and if they think you're funny or if they're just mortified.
I have two kids. One is 20 and one is 16, and I would suspect that there's probably a little bit of both. But
and in addition to your two kids and your husband, could you, just because you were telling us a little bit about her in the green room, could you tell us a little bit about your parrot?
Oh yes, I have three parrots. I have
three.
I have a parakeet. I don't know if this does not count. And I have a blue streak lory, and I have an African gray.
Who talks, right?
Yeah. And she, we don't need to go into all the detail about it, because I could talk about my birds forever, and that would be very boring. But they do talk.
Have they shown up in a cartoon yet?
No.
No? No. Or they're sacrosanct, perhaps?
Yes, they are.
They are.
This is the secret, this sacred place.
That's good to know.
My birds' lives.
Otherwise, little pieces of lint around the house could find their way into a cartoon, but not... Right. Not the parrots. Thank you all so much for coming, and Roz will be signing in the lobby.
Thanks.
Thank you, Roz.
Thanks.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.